Start your day, Tui, Rabbi Moshe Akiva Brandeis.
The Gemara tells the story, which, even if some of you may have heard the story before, if you indulge me for a few moments, and perhaps we can find some life lessons. The Gemara tells us in Tanis Chof Aleph Amud Beis that there was a man called Abba Umna, a doctor called Abba. And the Gemara says that this doctor Abba received a greeting from Shamayim, a heavenly greeting, every single day. It may have been Shalom Aleichem Reb Abba or Shalom Alecha Reb Abba, a greetings from heaven every day. Abaya, who was the leader of the generation, the leader of the town, the great Rosh Hashiva, says the Gemara, only received a greeting on every Erev Shabbos, once a week. Rava, his contemporary, received this greeting from Shomayim, from heaven, once a year, on Erev Yom Kippur. Naturally, Abaya was upset. He was hurt. What is it that this Dr. Abba is doing that he receives a greeting every single day, whereas I, who leads the generation, Abaya, there's hardly a daf of Gemara you can find without the word Abaya in it. And I only receive this message, this greeting, once a week. So the Gemara says that he received a message from Shemayim, a heavenly message, that told him, you have to understand that this Dr. Abba is a very special man. And you can't do the things that he does. And then the Gemara goes into detail and explains what this Dr. Abba did. The Gemara says how he would have two separate rooms. He guarded the tznius of men and women. You have to understand that in those days, in a waiting room of a doctor's office, it wasn't like today that everyone sits there like a statue waiting to be called in for however long it takes. It became a very social event, and people would schmooze with each other, and therefore it was important to segregate. That was one of the things. He looked after the dignity of his clients. He had a cloak which had flaps in it, so he only had to reveal what was necessary. The Gemara says how he had a slot in his clinic on the wall where you could pay as much as you wanted. No one knew how much was paid. Even the doctor himself had no idea. There was a slot, there was a price. If one could afford it, one paid. If not, one did not pay. And no one was the wiser. Everyone had the same treatment from the office because no one, including the doctor himself, had any idea who paid and how much. If a Talmud Chacham came, says the Gemara, he would rush him out. He wouldn't allow him to pay at all. Talmud Chacham. And because of this, he received this greeting on a daily basis. But still, it's still perplexing that this, fine, he was a perfect doctor, but Abaya was the leader of the generation. He was teaching Torah, which is still until today, to receive it less than this Dr. Abba. Second question. The parasha, Parashas Tetzaveh, begins with Shemen talking about the oil that was used in the Mishkan. It's an interesting choice to begin with in the parasha, to begin the parasha with Shemen, with oil. We find in Parashas Truma, it started with the Oren, understandable. The Oren is where the Luchos were. The Oren is in the Kodesh Kadoshim, the highest, most spiritual place in the Mishkan, understandable. But why is it that this week's parasha starts with the oil? It's the Erechaim's Kasha. Late in the parasha you have the tzitz that the Kohen Gadol wore, the Chosh and the Urim Atumim, which gave the answers to Klal Yisrael. It would seem that would be more befitting to be the start of the parasha. Thirdly, there's so much detail in these parashas, Truma and Tetzaveh. There's so much detail. The weight, the sizes, every aspect of the Mishkan is spoken about in detail. And if you think about it, the Mishkan was something which was only a one-time event. Even the Beis HaMikdash was not built with the dimensions of the Beis HaMikdash. Many, many parts of the Mishkan were never to be repeated. The roof of the Mishkan, made out of these materials or skins, didn't exist. The kroshim, the wooden beams, the adonim, so many aspects. We also find that the menorah, Moshe Rabbeinu found it very difficult. He found it challenging to build the menorah. Ask the Brisker Rav, what was so challenging about the menorah? In the Bayis Sheni, the second Beis HaMikdash, they built the menorah twice. They didn't seem to find it too difficult. With Hanukkah, then it was no longer. We know they built a wooden one for the time being in the story of Hanukkah. And later they built a second one. We don't find it was so challenging. Moshe Rabbeinu found it difficult to build the menorah. What was so difficult about building the menorah that Hashem revealed to him, Hashem showed him how to build it? Says the Brisker Rav, there was a difference. In the menorah of the Mishkan, every detail that Hashem showed him, in the vision of the menorah that Hashem showed him, thus shall be built the menorah, had to be built to the exact decimal point. Every single aspect, in measurement and in detail, had to be exactly the way the Ribbono Shel Olam showed it to him. That was difficult. To build it precisely, like the way you're shown, he found that challenging. However, in the Beis HaMikdash, as long as it looked like it, it had to have the buttons, it had to have the flowers, it had to be built to the dimensions, but the detail that the flower had to be to the exact measurement, the exact amount of gold, to the exact decimal point, that wasn't important. So to Brisker Rav, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu found it challenging. So you see that even in the details, there's many differences and many aspects of the Mishkan which had no relevance to future generations. So those are our three questions, perhaps seemingly unrelated at this point. I want to take a little roundabout route, go on a walk, and hopefully come across the answers to these questions. And perhaps in these questions, in the answers we'll find to these questions, we'll find the answers and a deeper understanding for the purpose of creation, what defines Klal Yisrael as a nation, and what defines us as individuals at each of our stations in life. Chamisha Chumshei Torah are our five Sfarim, the five books that Hashem gave us. There's a common ground, of course. It's Chamisha Chumshei Torah, but also each sefer, each volume, has its individual uniqueness. The Ramban in his Hakdama, in his introduction to Shemois, writes that Bereshis is the, let's call it the plantation. It's not the words of the Ramban. He explains that all that transpires and is told in Bereshis is really the Hakdama, is an introduction to what happens in Shemois. It's like the seeds that are planted which later grow in Shemois and thereafter throughout the generations, throughout history of Klal Yisrael. All is planted in Bereshis and then comes to fruition, grows in Shemois and for the generations that come to pass. And he writes that in Bereshis we find the prophecy of Klal Yisrael going into Golos, going to the Golos Mitzrayim, and eventually being redeemed, coming out to freedom. And he says, at what point did Klal Yisrael become free? So I asked this question, at what point did Klal Yisrael become free? Most people answer, when they left Mitzrayim. A nation that was in bondage for 210 years and finally are going free. No slave ever escaped Egypt. And here you have an entire nation leaving in broad daylight. That's freedom. Says Ramban, no. The freedom of Klal Yisrael came later. It came at Matan Torah. And if Ramban says that Matan Torah was the moment of freedom, we have to then understand what defines Klal Yisrael. What defines freedom? What defines a nation? Now, I couldn't find it this time round, but there is a Ramban, I believe it's a Ramban, elsewhere, who says that a nation generally is defined by three things. What defines a nation is its culture, its language, and its land. If you take the Japanese and you take away their land, and you take away their culture and all the left was their language, all you have is a bunch of people around the world that perhaps look similar, but they and happen to have a common language, but they're not a nation. If they're spread out across the world and all they have is a common language, even if they have a common culture, but they don't have their land, what makes them a nation? A nation needs language, culture, and land in order to be considered a nation. Klal Yisrael, if you think about it, had times throughout our history where we had neither of the three. We had no land, no language, no common language, and no common culture. After the Second World War, when all the Yidden were coming into Eretz Yisrael, you had the Yemenite Jew who turned up not speaking the language of the Russian Yid or the German Yid. No common culture. You couldn't compare the Moroccan Yid to the American who turned up. Each one had a beautiful tradition. They came with their own traditions, their own culture, their own language. They couldn't speak to each other. One came, but there was one thing that they had common amongst them. Perhaps the Moroccan or the Yemenite Yid turned up with a Sefer Torah which was encased in gold, in metal, in silver. And the Russian Yid may have turned up with a Sefer Torah in velvet. But the Sefer Torah inside was one and the same. What defines Klal Yisrael as a nation is the Sefer Torah. Is the Torah values, the Torah life, and the Torah itself is what defines us as a nation. As Zuzak the Ramban. And therefore we're a nation whether we have a land or not, whether we have a common culture or a common language or not. What binds us, what makes us, is Matan Torah. And therefore, the chairus, the freedom, the moment of becoming a nation is not when we left Mitzrayim. It's at the moment of Har Sinai. In Bereishis, it says, Yom HaShishi, the sixth day. It's the only day that it says the. HaShishi, Hey Ayidia. Why? Zograshi. Because we're waiting for the Vav, the sixth day of Sivan, which is Matan Torah. And Rashi says, it's not just about waiting for that moment, but he says all of creation was literally hanging on a thread until that moment. It wasn't established until the moment of Matan Torah. It's the purpose of creation. Yom HaShishi, VaYichulu HaShamayim. All of creation was created waiting and not established until that moment of Matan Torah, Vav Sivan. Where did all this power go of Matan Torah? Matan Torah was a tremendous, epic event. The entire world was silent. Wildlife, birds, it was 100% silence. The entire world was muted for the moment of Matan Torah, the purpose of creation itself. Powerful noises, thunder that was seen, lightning that was heard. It was a very powerful moment. Hashem spoke to Klal Yisrael. They literally were breathtaking. They lost their breath. They died. Malachim had to come. The angels had to come to resuscitate them. Where did all that power go? Let's look in the Rashi in Parashas Veschanon. The Pasuk says, V'lo Yosaf. It was never to be repeated. The moment of Matan Torah is never to be repeated. Says Rashi, one word, Bapumbi, in public. Let's make a diuk from this Rashi. A simple diuk. Let's extrapolate from this Rashi. He says, this will never take place again. Rashi doesn't just explain the word. He says, in public. In other words, in private, it would be repeated. Where's Matan Torah repeated in private? This colossal event of Matan Torah, the powerful moment where the Ribbono Shel Olam speaks to Klal Yisrael and gives them the purpose of creation, the Torah itself. Where is that repeated? Ramban, in this week's parasha, leaves us with the answer. The Ramban in this week's parasha writes these words, Yisoid HaMishkan Hu Sheyeh HaKovod HaShel HaSinai Shoichin Olav Benister. The purpose of the Mishkan is that the entire Kovod that existed at the time of Matan Torah should all exist in a more discreet fashion in the Mishkan. Let's take a moment to understand that. It means that the entire power of Matan Torah all existed in a more discreet way, in a more muted fashion in the Mishkan. Somehow. A person was able to suck in from the Mishkan all that was available at the moment of Har Sinai, at the moment of when we became a nation and received the Torah. And where did that go? We don't have a Mishkan today. The Pasuk says in last week's parasha, V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'seicham. I see some nodding heads. V'shachanti b'seicham, it doesn't say in it, which would be more grammatically correct. And I shall dwell in it, in the Mishkan. It says, and I shall dwell in them. Build me a sanctuary, build me a Mishkan, and I shall dwell in them. That doesn't follow. So Chazal tell us, V'shachanti b'seicham is b'seich kol echad ve'echad. And if we look at the Pasuk in the Haftarah of last week's parasha, where Shlomo HaMelech is building the Beis HaMikdash, Hashem actually says the word, it's not a diuk. Hashem says to him, V'shachanti, and I shall dwell, build me this Beis HaMikdash. And Hashem says to him, V'shachanti b'soich b'nei Yisrael. It doesn't say I shall dwell in the Beis HaMikdash, I shall dwell amongst the people. But let's take a moment, Rabbi Isai, to realize with the pattern that we've just built, with the building that we've just built, what comes out of this. The Ribbono Shel Olam created the world, Yom HaShishi, with the purpose of Matan Torah in mind. Matan Torah is this great event where Hashem speaks to us, where there's a Shechina, and we're all able to receive the glory of that moment, to connect to it, to receive the Torah, to become a nation, to become free. All that is concentrated in a more discreet way in the Mishkan. The entire power, the powerhouse of Matan Torah is concentrated in small, a more sublime way in the Mishkan. But if the Mishkan, if the Hashra'as HaShchina, if the dwelling of the Ribbono Shel Olam is in the Mishkan, but is spoken about as being b'seicham, b'seich b'nei Yisrael, into every individual. It means that the entire power of Matan Torah, and all that it entails, and all that it includes, is all concentrated in every single individual person in Klal Yisrael. It's not my vart, it's just what comes out of this point. It's fascinating. And it's kedai to spend a moment to think about the magnitude of this idea. If every individual has the Shechina, Hashra'as HaShechina, the power of Matan Torah inside us, we have to also understand that in every station in life, in every situation we happen to be in life, we have this connection. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Shlomo HaMelech, V'shachanti b'soich b'nei Yisrael, and the words that follow those words, do you mind to read them? So you open a chumash. V'le'ezev v'sami Yisrael. I don't have it in front of me. V'le'ezev v'sami Yisrael shall never forsake Klal Yisrael. Which means it's never to disappear. It's always true. It's not only as long as the Beis HaMikdash. I shall never forsake Klal Yisrael. I was once on a train from London Euston to Manchester Piccadilly. It was a late night train, the 11 o'clock train at the time. So it was an empty train, and the train manager, the one who collects the tickets and sells in the shop, was a little bit bored, I guess. Came over to me, we had a little chat. He didn't have too many people to collect tickets from at that time of night. And talking, I asked him what he did. He looked like he had a life before he became a train manager. He had other careers. So I asked him what he did in his younger years. So he told me that he was actually a soldier in the British Army. And he told me about his different missions around the world and the tropical islands he visited in Africa and Afghanistan and different places he had been to. And he's very proud of telling me about this, naturally. And I also told him naturally that I thanked him for protecting the British Isles on behalf of Queen and country. And then I said to him, I don't know why, but I got this sixth sense that perhaps he didn't look like he had been through too many battles in his life. I don't know why. And I said to him, what was your position in the army? And he said to me, it was in the kitchen. So he was peeling potatoes for many years. And I thought that as he answered this question, he would shrink a couple of inches from his proud statements earlier about visiting all these exotic countries. But no, he stood there proud and tall when he said, I worked in the kitchens. And in that, all in a few seconds of thought, I realized he's right. He's 100% right. The army fights from its stomach. You need satisfied soldiers who have morale and are powerful to fight the army. If he wouldn't peel those potatoes, those battles would be lost. We need the people in the tanks, the intelligence, we need the people in the planes, and we need the people in the kitchens peeling potatoes. Each one does their job. Each one has their role, and as a team of individuals, you have an army that wins. But every single aspect of the army is vital to the success of every battle. V'shachanti b'soich b'nei Yisrael is kol echad v'echad b'soicham, in every single individual, because every single individual is needed for the success of the nation. In this week's parasha, the luchos being placed in the aron is mentioned twice. Rashi says, do you know why it's mentioned twice? To tell you the order of how it should be done. First, place the luchos inside the aron, and then put the lid on. Because the pasuk says it in that order, it's mentioned twice to tell you that it must be in that order. Rashi. It's a very strange Rashi. Because if you give any child a toy that you have to put something inside and then close the lid, he'll do it in that order. It's practically the only way you can get the item inside. You put the item inside, then you put the lid on. Why do you need a posuk to tell you that that's the way to put the luchos into the aron? But Rashi says that's why it's repeated. Needs explanation. The Minchas Asher brings from the Maharal. In the second Beis HaMikdash there was no aron. Yuman and Gimel Amud Beis. There was no aron in the second Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because there were no luchos. Says the Maharal, this pasuk repeats the din twice to tell you that luchos are ma'akev, the aron. You must have luchos in order to have an aron. If you don't have luchos, no aron. You must have luchos in order to have aron. And therefore, in the second Beis HaMikdash, there were no luchos, there's no aron. Sorry? That's right. No, in the second Beis HaMikdash, where they didn't have. But why can't you have an aron without luchos? That's the question. Yeah, make a new aron. Without luchos. Zog de Maharal, you must have luchos in order to have an aron. That's why they didn't build, yeah? That's why they did not build an aron. So the Minchas Osher, he's a Lamed Shiva over here, he says, do you know what's pshat in this Rashi? So I'll tell you pshat in this Rashi. He says, Rashi's telling you that you need to put the luchos in first and only then put the lid on, because otherwise you don't have an oren. If you've built the oren and only then place the luchos inside, your oren is no good. You have to have the luchos inside before it's considered an oren. Now, you can put the lid on. When you create the oren in the first place, it has to be an oren. How is that with the luchos inside? He says, although practically there's no other way to do it, Rashi is telling you, the Torah is telling you that one needs the other. You cannot have an oren without luchos. Nice lamda shiva, but I want to take out the same point here. The purpose of the entire world is the Mishkan. The purpose of the Mishkan is the oren. Therefore, Truma starts with the oren. What's in the oren? The luchos, Matan Torah. Without that, let's go backwards. You don't have an oren, you don't have a Mishkan, you don't have purpose of creation. The luchos is the very purpose of creation. Matan Torah, the moment we became a nation. Living a Torah life is the purpose of creation itself. And then, the purpose of us, in our own stations in life, in our own individualistic situations. Now we can go back to understand the three questions we started with. Why do we have all the protim, all the detail of the Mishkan, down to every point and flowers and buttons, kroshim, which we said has no relevance in the future. The Beis HaMikdash was not based on many aspects which were vital to the Mishkan. But the Mishkan is the remez, is the blueprint of the human being, of us as individuals. And if you go through the Kliyoka on this week's parasha and other mafarshim, they go through in detail how the menorah, the oren, and the shulchan all have relevances to our lives. So the details, perhaps in its physical form, were only in the Mishkan. But as a blueprint for our lives as Torah Yidden, it's all in the detail of the Mishkan. The Kroshim and the Adonim, just then as an example, Moshe Feinstein writes in last week's parasha, the last posuk of last week's parasha, where the Adonim were held, the Kroshim, the beams were held down by strings with a weight. Says Moshe Feinstein, why does Rashi wonder if those weights were in the ground or above the ground? Why is it important? Who cares? Were the weights that held up the beams which surrounded the Mishkan, were they held in place by putting them into the ground, or were they held in place simply by their own weight? Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, there's a message here for life. And the message is that all that we do has to be in such a way in Avodas Hashem, that at the beginning we do it with encouragement, by being inspired. But we should make sure that inspiration and that which we do in our Avodas Hashem has long-lasting effects. So that at the beginning it's in the ground, supported by the ground around us, by the people who encouraged us, or encourage us, inspiration that we find, that we read, that we hear. But then let's let it sink in a way that now we have our own weight. We carry our own weight. So even if the earth around us is not supporting anymore, in a moment where we don't have that friend, in a moment where we don't have that sefer that inspired us, but the inspiration sunk in to the extent that we carry our own weight. We don't need the ground anymore. The weight is holding up the kroshim. It's an example of how so many aspects of the Mishkan, although not relevant in their physical form, have an everlasting message for each of us as individuals. And then we ask, why does the parasha begin with shemen, with oil? Why oil? We have the Urim U'Tumim we could have mentioned. Truma starts with the oroin, the purpose of creation, understandable. Why does this week parasha begin with shemen, oil? The tzitz maybe. The Choshen with Urim U'Tumim. The Urachayim writes, that Shemen is a remez, alludes to the Torah. Just like shemen, when you light it, it enlightens all that's around it. It brings light to the world. So too the Torah enlightens the world. And therefore tetzaveh begins with shemen. And following the idea that this is the very purpose of creation, coming to Matan Torah, coming to the Mishkan, coming to us as individuals, it's very in place to begin Parashas Tetzaveh, again with an orin, the shemen, which is also a remez to the Torah. And the story we started with was Abba Umna. Abba Umna. And the strange fact that he receives a greeting from Hashem every single day as a doctor. And Abaya, the great Amora, leader, Rosh Hashiva, Abaya, only receives a greeting from Shemaim on Fridays and Erev Shabbos. And Ravan only on Erev Yom Kippur. And Abaya's hurt. If we read the Gemara further in Tanis, the Gemara says, Abaya, you can't do what he does. But he's the leader of the generation. And the Gemara, like I told you, goes into detail about how this Dr. Abba behaved in the best possible way of being a doctor to his clients. Is that greater than Abaya? Even if we say he was living up to his standard, is that greater than the Abaya? Let's understand what the Gemara is saying. You cannot do what he does. In other words, your role is different to his. It's not about better or worse. It's not about levels in the real world. It's about roles. Individual roles. Abaya, says the Gemara in Ahmed Aleph. Abaya, you, in your zechus, you and Rava, the entire city is sustained. Dailecha, it's enough for you that the entire city has what to eat in your merit. In other words, your zchus, your merit, is simply different to that of Dr. Abba, this Abba Umna. Our way of telling Dr. Abba that his way in the world, his behavior with his clients, is perfect, is so special, is by greeting him every day. It's not the same for you. You have your unique role. For you, Abaya, for you, Rava, it's that the town is sustained in your merit. People are making business deals and successful in your merit. People have what to eat in your merit. That's what Shemayim was telling him. It's just different. It's not about higher and lower. It's just unique. And therefore, the message that the Gemara is telling us in Tanis is that yes, we have the entire Matan Torah encompassed, concentrated in the Mishkan and thereby in every individual. But every individual is different as a complete separate role to anyone else in the world. The Ira Chaim writes, again in this week's Parsha, Al Pi the Zohar HaKadosh, four Goliyos. Until Mashiach comes, there'll be four Goliyos. He says, the first Golos is Avram Avinu's redemption, Mitzrayim. Second is Yitzchak, third is Yaakov, and the final Golos will be Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what he writes. He says, Ve'ato Tetzaveh. The very first words of this week's parasha, Ve'ato Tetzaveh, says that Ira Chaim is from the Loshon of Kimalochov Yitzaveh Loch. And he says, Ein Tzaveh La Loshon Malchus, meaning, Tzaveh, the expression of Ve'ato Tetzaveh, and you shall command, is an expression of Malchus. It's an expression of royalty. An expression of a king. It's a royal message. What is this? It says, Ve'ato Tetzaveh alludes to the end of days. When Moshe Rabbeinu will be Tetzaveh, when he'll be Kimalochov Yitzaveh Loch, Ein Tzaveh Laloshen Malchus, when Moshe Rabbeinu will be the king of Klal Yisrael, when Mashiach comes. Then exactly how, when this will happen. Moshe Rabbeinu will be there with Mashiach and be the Melech of Klal Yisrael. Says the Ira Chaim, Moshe Rabbeinu being there at the redemption, at the time of Mashiach, means that Moshe Rabbeinu wants a world which connects to him. Which is, Moshe Rabbeinu is the Moshe HaTorah. Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who brought Torah to Klal Yisrael. So he says Moshe Rabbeinu wants Klal Yisrael to be Oisik by Torah of HaMitzvahs. He wants Klal Yisrael to be a nation that is connected to the Luchos in the Aron. That's connected to a life of Torah. That's connected to Limud HaTorah. That Torah is part of their day. That mitzvahs are important to them. He says, then Moshe Rabbeinu will feel comfortable to be there at the time of Mashiach. I want to share a short story about a girl, not so simple. A simple girl, but she wasn't so simple, as you'll see in the story. And it tells us how we can find in one person, in one individual, a fascinating Matan Torah in such a discreet way in one individual. This girl was a Beis Yaakov girl in America, and her mother went through a phase where she became a little fanatic about health foods. It happens. And she told the family that from now on it's organic only and we're having oats for supper, etc. Vegetables, oats, all organic. And this girl, being a regular teenager, says she's not eating supper tonight. The father says, come, look, please, just come for supper. Make mommy happy. She's like, I'm not eating this food. I'll find something to eat later. I'm not eating this food. The girl goes upstairs to her room. Father follows her. He says, do me a favor. This is going to pull the family apart. Mum will pass this stage of life just for the time being. You know? Join us for supper. Eat something. She says, you know what, Father? Let's make a deal. There's something I want to do. If you allow me to do that which I want to do, I'll go and eat supper. He says, what is it? I prefer not to say. Okay. You're quite a reasonable girl. Agreed. Fine. She goes downstairs and eats supper. Then he says, what is it you want to do? She says, I want to shave my head. He says, I'm being serious. She says, I agreed to the deal because I thought you were reasonable. Daddy, we made a deal. I did my part of the deal. I'm now going to do my part of the deal. You agree? I'm going upstairs. He says, come on, you can't. Daddy, we made a deal. It was agreed. But I understand. She goes upstairs, takes a razor and shaves her head. He doesn't know what's come over her, his otherwise normal, balanced daughter. Next morning, he wants to take her to school. He says, do you not want a bandana, something, you know, a pea cap? No, I'm fine. She's going to school and he just can't work out what's going on in his head. He drives her to school. She goes out, square-shouldered, walking along as if nothing's different today, into the school grounds, and his head's spinning. He can hardly drive home. He comes home, and the phone is ringing and ringing. He takes the phone. There's a woman who can hardly speak on the phone, and she says, do you know, my daughter was diagnosed a few months ago with cancer, and she went through treatments, and she lost her hair. And she came back to school, and teenagers being teenagers, she was teased. And with all the pressure and trauma of the illness, added to children teasing her in school, she hasn't turned up to school in weeks. Last night, your daughter called, and she said, now there's two of us. We both don't have hair. And for the first time in weeks, my daughter has come back to school. Klal Yisrael has the power of Har Sinai in every individual. the magnitude and epic moment of Matan Torah, where the Ribbono Shel Olam gave the Torah to Klal Yisrael, in all its power exists in a discrete form in every individual. And so when Moshe Rabbeinu will come to redeem us, Bimei Moshiach, it'll be Moshe Rabbeinu who wants to see how we're keeping the Torah, like the Luchos in the Orin, which had all of Matan Torah concentrated in them. And finally, in each of us as individuals, when we take a see it, Bimhirav Yameinu.